This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Donald Trump continues to dominate political headlines and spill over into New Hampshire's high-profile Senate race. Here's Maggie Hassan during a foreign policy speech this week.
All of these efforts to keep our nation safe, secure, and strong are only possible if we have leaders who will always put country before their political party.
Senator Kelly Ayotte, meanwhile, continues to hold steady and support, but not endorse Trump.
Obviously there's a presidential race going on. I've said that I'm going to be voting for our nominee, but I've also been quite clear when I've had disagreements with him, which I will continue to do.
And marijuana is on the state's mind this week as a fourth medical dispensary opens in Windham and candidates for governor debate decriminalization. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Give us a call. The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook, Twitter. Good morning. I'm Josh Rogers. Joining us today is Kevin Landrigan, senior reporter of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Allie Morris, State House reporter at The Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. So I guess we need to start with Donald Trump. He was here last weekend and has made a mountain of news since of comments ranging from Second Amendment people taking action against Hillary Clinton in the context of judicial nominations, saying that President Obama and Hillary Clinton are, quote, founders of ISIS. Donald Trump says he's being sarcastic in some of these comments. I think we've all been struggling to find comparison and ways to contextualize Donald Trump's rhetoric. It seems I was waiting for Donald Trump's so-called post-primary pivot, maybe waiting forever. What do you think about that, Dean?
Yeah, I don't sense that there's going to be any pivot forthcoming. That was the story for a long time, that once the party got through the convention, he would pivot and be more presidential, although he himself has said that being presidential is boring. I think he likes the excitement and the adrenaline that he gets from these crowds at these rallies. It has been his strategy for a long time to ride the news cycle, to see if he can work the news cycle. I think it's become a little more complicated for him now that we're in a general election, but it worked quite well for him in the primary, so he's figuring just continue with more of the same. But it literally is kind of a daily controversy. And then, you know, one of the kind of speculative games that goes along with this is, you know, what will he say that will finally break the back of yet another Republican who has grudgingly supported him? We saw Susan Collins from Maine say that she won't vote for him. There seems to be almost a daily watch on Kelly Ayotte to see whether or not he will do something that will finally break her support. There's a lot of concern among Republicans that that he needs to adjust his strategy. It's not clear that he will. I think he's, you know, he is who he is at this point, and he seems to like the way that he campaigns. And when he does occasionally adjust, maybe sticking to a teleprompter moderating his tweeting a little bit, it doesn't last for very long. And we end up back where we have been all along with him, which is this kind of visceral, shoot from the hip, very kind of personalized notion of campaigning. And, you know, some people love it, but there are an awful lot of people who find it troubling.
Well, obviously, in a presidential year, the top of the ticket tends to create an atmosphere in which all the other races exist in and among. Kevin, I mean, do you see it likely that that there are going to be more Republicans in New Hampshire who will try to make some sort of clean break from Trump, or are we kind of where we are?
Yeah, I think – thanks, Josh, for the question. I think we are where we are simply because, one, Donald Trump had a pretty historic, overwhelming victory over a lot of opponents in the First in the Nation primary. I think, for better or worse, even a lot of elective office holders don't want to really take on Trump in New Hampshire. But there's but no question we're going to continue right up until Election Day to evaluate, and most of us will be wrong, about what the Trump impact will be down ballot. We heard reports this week about Republican National Committee Chairman Rince Priebus wanting a come-to-Jesus meeting with Trump. And the meeting was essentially about, look, I've got to make a decision. This is Priebus to Trump. I've got to make a decision, basically, whether to leave you on your own and spend a lot of our resources and staff and time trying to save Republicans down ballot, whether it's Kelly out in New Hampshire, Rob Portman in Ohio, other key states in order to keep the Republican majority. It's a serious concern. But in states like New Hampshire that are swing states, it's not uncommon for a Hillary Clinton to win New Hampshire, but a Kelly Ayotte to win re-election. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be comfortable, but it's happened before. It can still happen.
I mean, it was interesting. Allie and I, we were both at the Hassan's foreign policy speech earlier in the week, and the degree. And this is an area where Kelly Ayotte would seem to have an edge by dint of her experience and serving on the Armed Services Committee. And this was a speech where the perception was that Governor Hassan needed to flesh out where she stood on some of these issues. And, you know, throughout the speech, like a drumbeat was, you know, Donald Trump, Donald Trump. And, you know, what do you think this means for the debate on foreign policy? I mean, we can hear what Governor Hassan said, but, I mean, were you struck by that as well?
Yeah, you know, she went after Kelly Ayotte saying, you know, she didn't mention her by name, but she said, you know, voters should question any elected official who supports Donald Trump. They should question their merits on national security because Hassan sort of cast him as a dangerous person who would have the nuclear codes, for example. And, you know, I think Democrats are really going to push this for the entire election. But I think at the same time, if Kelly Ayotte and other Republicans relented, they would still face these same attacks from Democrats that, you know, they're waffling, they can't make up their mind. So I think it's sort of a lose-lose for Republicans when it comes to this issue. And honestly, I mean, we saw with Kelly Ayotte, you know, Donald Trump attacked her, even though she has voiced some sort of tepid support for him. And so I think the danger that some of these Republicans run is, you know, do they focus on winning votes in New Hampshire or do they turn it into a battle between them and Trump, which it could be, you know, if they come out against him. And I think then they're worried that that would distract from the message that they're trying to get to voters, which in Kelly Ayotte's case is that she can work across the aisle. She can work with people in both parties. And I think that's the message she's trying to push, not getting into a battle with Donald Trump.
That, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, and that's not an unusual strategy for somebody running for Congress. You typically want to make it about what you bring home to the state, particularly in times of sort of great polarization nationally. You want to kind of get away from that. And I think that's what, you know, Kelly Ayotte is trying to do that. Obviously, other people running for Congress, even Frank Ginta, is trying to do that as well. So it's a common strategy. And I think you're right, Allie, that it's unclear sort of what's to be gained for Kelly Ayotte in this whole do you support Trump issue, because she is kind of, you know, they say you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. Either way, she's going to still get it from the Democrats. And in the end, she's kind of, regardless, she's sort of hostage to what happens at the top of the ticket.
Well, why don't we take a listen to some of what was said this week about foreign policy? Why don't we listen first to what Governor Hassan had to say in Manchester?
From praising Vladimir Putin, Kim Jong-un, and Saddam Hussein, to refusing to commit to defending our NATO allies, to urging Russia to commit cyber attacks against Americans, to despicably attacking a Gold Star family, and signaling his openness to preemptively deploying nuclear weapons, it's clear that Trump is woefully unfit to serve as our commander-in-chief.
Okay, that was Maggie Hassan earlier this week at the Sweeney Post in Manchester outlining her foreign policy vision, and in that clip, obviously taking after comments made by GOP nominee Donald Trump. Now, one thing that is interesting on the foreign policy front is that the point of the main thrust of what Governor Hassan had to say was that she cast herself as a candidate who would be willing to break with her party when need be. And the issues she cited were Syrian refugees and Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, Kelly Ayotte has been somebody who's been very aggressive on Guantanamo Bay. Kevin, you wrote about some news she broke this week regarding Guantanamo. What was that?
Yeah. She, for several years, Senator Ayotte, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, has been doing a lot of work on her own about the releases of detainees, suspected terrorists, from Guantanamo Bay prison in Canada. Now, as a senator, she has that classified status, so she can go into a room in private and look at all the background about these detainees that are getting released. And she became alarmed at how many terrorist ties some of these people who had been released. So she was determined to have the public to give some transparency to this. So she put onto the last defense authorization bill last fall a requirement that a report be done by the Department of Defense on these detainees. It was supposed to be done within 60 days. It was not. So AOT moved to place a hold on a nomination of a Department of Defense general counsel. AOT's a very, I won't say super cautious, but careful senator. So to place a hold like that is significant, and it indicated how upset she was. It worked. They got a report. She got a report, the first time ever report, comprehensive on all the detainees as of last November, the 107 detainees. And it certainly was illuminating for me to go through it. It wasn't the report she wants and still is looking for. It's not a complete dossier on all these folks, but it's a pretty detailed paragraph on each one. And many of Osama bin Laden's inner circle were in or are in Guantanamo Bay. The person who was believed to be the 20th hijacker on 9/11, who got detained at Orlando Airport and got sent back to United Arab Emirates, is in Guantanamo Bay. But there are also others, like a guy who went to work at one of the training camps not knowing it was a terrorist training camp as a cook, never saw any action. And another who was actually a beekeeper who basically joined the training force because he feared for his family who had been threatened. So it does sort of run the gamut. But Senator Ayotte thought it was important that the public know as much as possible about who these folks are. As you know, President Obama has been trying for 8 years to close this prison. He's been effectively drawing it down. There are now only 76 detainees. At one point, there are over 900 at Guantanamo. He hopes to have it cut by half by the time he leaves office. So effectively, he's hoping it could eventually be drawn down. Ayotte says as long as I'm a U.S. senator, Guantanamo Bay will remain open.
Well, you know, Governor Hassan hasn't been, quite that specific. But obviously, this is an area where she, broke with Obama some time ago. I mean, do you get a sense from talking to voters that Guantanamo Bay is something that they're thinking much about, Allie?
It's not the first issue that comes up in voters' minds, but I do think that national security is the top issue that voters are thinking of this election cycle. You know, Josh, when we were at the Republican convention, I talked to most of the delegates, and they said national security, immigration are some of the top things that are on their mind. So I think any issue that either Hassan or Ayotte can paint as something that is protecting residents, protecting voters, is an issue that's going to have resonance with them.
And if you think about how big Guantanamo Bay was as an issue symbolically, yes, back in 2007, 2000, the 2008 campaign, and then one of President Obama's first actions as president was to lay out this plan that just hasn't come to fruition. It really has kind of been swamped as an issue by the rise of ISIS. And I think the thinking was, we wind down Afghanistan, we wind down Iraq, we wind down Guantanamo. Now you have a whole new terrorist threat that we're dealing with. And I think there's going to be a lot of hesitancy among members of Congress, and certainly Governor Hassan has suggested as well, to completely close in and bring those individuals who were there onto the U.S. mainland.
Well, Kellyanne spoke this week with NH1. Why don't we listen to what she had to say, talking about foreign policy and specifically the Obama administration?
We've seen ISIS rise and be a threat not only in Iraq and Syria, but with the attacks that they've been able to carry out or inspire around the world. We have a situation where what happened in Libya, there was no follow-up to make sure that the weapons that were present in Libya, that there was the kind of follow-up to make sure that those weapons didn't go awash in the Middle East. When it comes to the reset policy with Russia, as I look at where we are with this administration and that policy, that unfortunately has been a failure. And then finally, there's the Iran deal.
That was Kellyanne speaking to NH1 earlier this week. And that response was a portion of a response to a question whether she was asked whether she trusted Donald Trump with the country's nuclear codes. And so you can see to the extent that that Maggie Hassan wants to make the discussion of foreign policy largely a referendum on Donald Trump. Senator Ayotte and Republicans want to shift this to what they see as weaknesses of the Obama administration. And obviously, you know, Kellyanne has the you know, arguably the disadvantage of having had to actually vote on things as a member of the Senate. I mean, one thing that Governor Hassan has going for her is the fact that she doesn't, and she hasn't. And, you know, you look, it's a lot easier to be independent of your party when you're not asked to vote for things.
Good point, Josh. And also it's a lot easier to kind of weave a fabric of your views on foreign policy when the most foreign policy thing you've done as governor is maybe mobilize the National Guard to clean up after a flood in New Hampshire. So Hassan has been able to craft this kind of centrist, almost on some issues, almost hawkish view on foreign policy, as we saw in her speech talking about wanting to give the authorization for use of force against ISIS, basically a blanket check to an administration in the future to go after and take out these guys and use force whenever the administration deems necessary. Going back to what Dean was saying earlier, Guantanamo Bay was a flashpoint in the 2008 campaign. I think it may well be, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, a look into how a President Clinton will be different than President Obama. Hillary Clinton, the candidate in 2008, was more hawkish than President Obama. Hillary Clinton was less bothered by the fact that these folks at Guantanamo Bay are denied all due process, are in many cases just thrown into that cell for 14, 15 years and forgotten once they're interrogated and whatever is to be gotten out of them is gotten out of them. That doesn't bother candidate Hillary Clinton. That didn't bother Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And I don't think it'll bother President
and
Hillary
to
Clinton.
The extent that you're seeing Republicans line up behind Hillary Clinton, they tend to come from the national security community because yes. precisely because, as you say, she's a bit more hawkish yes. than President Obama. And then just real quickly on the governorship, you know, this is a challenge for all governors. They typically don't have foreign policy experience unless they are coming from the U.S. Congress to become governor. And typically they talk about their trade experience because they have trade missions. But she's been very outspoken. And as you mentioned, it's because there really is no sort of voting record on those issues for her.
I do think that there is something, well, you know, while Governor Hassan hasn't voted on these issues, I do think it is noteworthy that she did take a stand on Syrian refugees. She faced a lot of blowback from within yes. her own party. She was one of more than, I think, 30 governors nationwide who said that the U.S. should stop accepting Syrian refugees in wake of the Paris terror attacks. You know, that wasn't a vote, and the federal government is actually the one that controls refugee resettlement. The governors can't actually sway that very much, and New Hampshire has even taken some Syrian refugees since she made those comments. But I do think that shows, you know, kind of where she stands as a governor on some of these issues where she hasn't had a vote, but she certainly had a voice on some national security issues.
She has. And, you know, she said as governor, you know, when there's a snowstorm or in her speech the other day, that the first job of government is to keep the people safe. And you're right that she did face a lot of blowback from within her own party, whether or not that has any effect, you know, come election day, you know, is an open question.
It really is. I think you're right. I, as Ali pointed out, I think national security remains a very important issue. I think it will be until the general election. And in my view, I certainly don't have any intelligence about this, but I do think the terrorists, ISIS, the groups that want to wage jihad, if you will, are egging for President Donald Trump. And they think it'd be very good for recruitment. And I think that's one of the reasons, it's a small part of the reasons why we're seeing an escalated number of events all over the world.
All right. Coming up more on the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute on NHPR. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. You can join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Joining us this week is Kevin Landrigan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Ali Morris from the Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. We've been talking presidential politics. Let's turn to vice presidential politics for a minute. Tim Kaine is a due to arrive in New Hampshire tomorrow. He's going to be in Manchester, and he's going to be doing a fundraiser. New Hampshire doesn't strike me as a state where likely where people are likely to be electrified by a visit of a vice presidential candidate or jaded. But you know, why do you think Tim Kaine's coming here, Kevin?
Well, I do think it's Senator Kaine, former Democratic National Chairman Kaine, is a prodigious fundraiser, very good. And it's one of the reasons he was put on the ticket. It's not the only reason. It's probably not even the best reason. But Kaine has a real ability to connect nationally with big-time Democratic donors, even some who, frankly, have Clinton fatigue, you know. So I think that's – this visit is part of a national tour, if you will. It's almost, I liken it almost to a book tour by, you know, a famous author, which is, you make the announcement of the, you give the tease out about the book, and then you send him or her across the country to sign books and make money and generate sales. That's essentially what we have here. He's, I believe this is the 8th of 13 states that where Kaine is essentially going to go, have a fundraiser, and then the next day or the morning before, give a policy speech, and he will be giving a policy speech about the Clinton jobs plan that she's going to be talking about at the end of this week.
So are you going to be covering it, Allie?
I will not be there.
Okay, I'm going to be there.
We'll be there.
But I think part of it, too, is that I think somewhat surprisingly to people, Donald Trump has been here a number of times since he became the presumed nominee and then the official nominee. He's made, I think, at least three or four trips to New Hampshire himself. And I think Hillary Clinton's made one since she was named. And I think as people are looking sort of towards the general election at the Electoral College votes, people see New Hampshire. We only have four votes in that race. But I think as they're doing the math, they see New Hampshire could play a critical role. You know, in 2000, obviously, New Hampshire, Al Gore lost New Hampshire by about 7,000 votes, and that was a key loss for him in the race. So I think that people are sort of stacking the math, and, you know, the Clinton camp is sending Tim Kaine up here, you know, maybe to try to rival some of the campaign events that Donald Trump has held in New Hampshire to try to rally voters here before the election.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, I think part of it is fundraising. I think part of it is calculations about the Electoral College. But it's also the case that New Hampshire just works really well for these kinds of rallies. It's a quick plane flight from anywhere in the Northeast to get good media coverage in a whole number of different states. And we're just sort of really good at kind of the process of hosting these sorts of events. So you often see candidates come up here for a variety of reasons, even if it may not be initially clear why they've chosen New Hampshire.
Here's what's kind of unique, too, about New Hampshire and the swing state phenomenon, and it's got everything to do with Donald Trump. And Allie's right, that's why Kaine is here. It's a big part of why Kaine is here. It's Hillary Clinton's doing extremely well in some states she has no business doing well in, like Utah. The Mormons are very angry at Trump. And suddenly Utah is in play. North Carolina is another state where she's doing extremely well. So if some of those states that typically Democrats don't do well somehow tip to her, then the math changes really well for her. And New Hampshire's four electoral states become important, and here's why. If I get Utah and I get North Carolina and then I get New Hampshire's four votes, I don't need Florida in order to be president, or I don't need Ohio in order to be president. Or Pennsylvania could flip to him, and I'm still president. That's what keeps New Hampshire here. Under any scenario right now, Trump needs New Hampshire. He's still likely to lose in November. He can still win. He's still likely to lose, but he absolutely needs to keep coming back here. And it's one of the reasons he often trips over into Maine, because he could use one of those congressional district electoral votes that Maine offers.
All right. Well, why don't we shift a little bit more locally and talk a little bit about marijuana. New Hampshire's fourth medical marijuana dispensary opens as the Drug Enforcement Agency declines to reclassify marijuana. Kevin, you had an article this morning on this. What does the decision by the DEA mean?
Yeah, it's not really a surprising decision by DEA, but it's likely the last word from the Obama presidency, right? So it's kind of important. The DEA essentially refused to declassify marijuana. What does that mean? Marijuana is considered a class one controlled drug, along with heroin, which is the most dangerous form. Now, it was put back then. I mean, this is a very historical phenomenon. Marijuana was put as a classified class one drug back during the reefer madness. I mean, back when a lot less was understood about marijuana and a lot of fears were there about marijuana. And medical providers essentially say, here's the problem. Once you make it a class one drug, it's almost impossible to declassify it. You've got to essentially show scientific evidence that it's safe for use in order to declassify it. Just to put in some perspective, cocaine and fentanyl are not class one. They're class two. So they're actually considered safer drugs than marijuana. This upsets folks that support legalization, that support decriminalization. And in the DEA, in making that decision, also said we do not sanction medical marijuana, even though there are 25 states, including New Hampshire and the District of Columbia, where it is legal to prescribe medical marijuana. The federal government's not giving its imprimatur for it. It also points out, however, this is not – just should not signal to those states that we're taking a different enforcement policy. Translation, there's not going to be any crackdown in states that have medical marijuana laws.
But this comes as the National Conference of State Legislatures seeking reclassification.
Yes.
The Clinton campaign has said Hillary Clinton would support a reclassification.
And you've got five states. I should say, you've got five states this November voting, including Massachusetts and Maine, voting on legalizing marijuana use for adults. You've got three other states voting on medical marijuana referendums as well. So we've essentially got half the states in the country supporting it, more than half the population, I might add, and that could grow by this November.
So, Ali, you've covered medical marijuana as it's made its transit. Do you think that this is the full implementation is certainly a relief to patients who have been waiting for this for some time. Do you think that the push to loosen marijuana laws is going to pick up steam at the State House?
It's been a really tough issue for New Hampshire's lawmakers. I think New Hampshire has sort of been slow among the New England states to implement some of these policies. And, you know, we saw even with medical marijuana, it was passed several years ago. And just now the last dispensary is opening, which is several months behind schedule. So I think there has been frustration among patients that this wasn't moving as quickly as they had hoped. And I think now it's finally starting to move on. I think the next debate will be about decriminalizing marijuana, which, you know, that has been waged at the State House for some time. A bill of that nature has never passed the Senate before. And while there was a glimmer of hope, I think a year or two ago, the compromise deal just totally fell apart. And I think some of the opponents of decriminalization are now pointing to the current opioid crisis as reason for why it's not the time to loosen drug penalties in the state. They say that they hear from users frequently of heroin and harder drugs like fentanyl that they started out using drugs, including marijuana. And so I think that sort of swayed some lawmakers that, you know, now is not the time to reduce those penalties.
I mean, some have said to me on that front that even though they, you know, kind of off the record, they're like, I don't have any problem with it, but I just think it will send a bad message to the public to seemingly be operating, you know, at cross purposes.
Yeah, you know, I think that Ali's right. This was just a tremendously long process to get these dispensaries up and running. You know, and I think you we'll continue to have this debate over decriminalization. I think the House has approved it something like seven or eight times in the last 8 years. But it may take a while. I think we're still a distance away from full legalization. I think that part, and that sort of gets into the whole issue of how the federal government classifies it as a drug. One other area where I think you'll see some push is to kind of expand the range of conditions and illnesses that allow you to qualify for a medical marijuana card. It's very narrow and strict in New Hampshire compared to what you see in other states. And I think there's going to be a push to broaden the definition of who qualifies for it.
Well, one place where we have seen this issue and potentially even legalization come up is in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. Legalization is something that Steve Marchand, former Portsmouth mayor, has been talking up. And why don't we take a listen to what he said on WGIR this week?
Yeah, I'm the only candidate in either party running for governor this year that favors the legalization, regulation, and taxation of marijuana. I do so for three reasons. Number one, I think it'll actually help with the heroin and opiate issue in that a lot of people that use prescription opiates that lead to fentanyl and heroin could not get on that train by avoiding using opiates in the first place. Second is it'll reduce cost in law enforcement, judicial, and incarceration because they can now use those resources to chase down the crimes that we want them to do. And the third is it'll generate a significant amount of money.
That was Steve Marchand speaking in a debate on WGIO radio. So, Ali, what do you make of that? Earnest policy belief, attempt to get traction in a Democratic primary, a little bit of both?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. And, you know, we talked about how decriminalization hasn't really gotten much traction at the legislature. You know, the majority of gubernatorial candidates say that they would sign a bill to decriminalize marijuana. The only two who wouldn't are Mayor Gatsis of Manchester and State Senator Jeanne Forrester. So I think Steve Marchand is kind of getting out ahead of that to kind of push the next policy frontier. And, you know, we've actually seen a lot of polls in New Hampshire that show a majority of residents support legalizing marijuana. And I think that his view will probably resonate with a number of voters who see, you know, we sell alcohol on the side of the road. You know, what's wrong with doing the same thing with marijuana? And I think that he may sway some voters. And I think especially with, you know, a lot of people are turning their backs on casinos, just given that that doesn't seem like a really popular prospect anymore. I think he's trying to capitalize on, you know, marijuana may be the next best thing when if we need, you know, a couple million dollars to help boost the budget, this is where we could look.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Who knows about the numbers? I know that Colorado's revenue targets and their legalization haven't quite come in. And, you know, one thing that Kevin mentioned earlier that I also think is interesting and worth noting is that, you know, the whole, you know, obviously we don't have a marijuana, you know, we need to have a constitutional amendment regarding marijuana. We don't have that on the ballot, obviously, this year. But in states where the referenda are taking place, and I think that there are also some states that have referenda that are looking to crack down on marijuana. I think there are, you know, more than a dozen. Is that, you know, Democrats do see this as a way to spur turnout among young people. And they point to Colorado in 2008 as a place, or 2012, I guess, as a place where, you know, the marijuana had an impact changing the electorate. And I do think that this is something that Democrat strategists are looking at nationally and saying this is a way to potentially mobilize, you know, parts of the coalition that helped get Barack Obama elected.
Yeah, it's a really good point, Josh. And I think certainly there are some, we've all probably talked to them, people in the Democratic Party think on part of Steve Marchand that some of this is political calculation, which is whether it's supporting repeal of the death penalty and taking cop killer Michael Addison off death row, whether it's raising back up business taxes, and whether it's legalizing marijuana. These are all very liberal positions. And if it is political calculation, frankly, it's pretty smart. And here's why. In September, this is the only race on the ballot to speak of in the Democratic primary. So this electorate could be very small and it could be very liberal. And if I was someone like Colin Van Osten, who's the perceived frontrunner in this race, a guy like Steve Marchand would worry me because he's put together this kind of issue packet that I just talked about that is very appealing to very liberal Democrats.
Well, he's also talked about, you know, sort of rejiggering local aid. Why don't we hear from what Colin Van Osten said during this same debate on business taxes? You said that Steve Marchand has struck out the position that we ought to reverse the tax cuts that took place. Here's what Colin Van Osten had to say about this.
I can tell you what is absolutely critical for a growing New Hampshire business is predictability. They do not deserve to be treated like the yo-yo at the end of a string. And I think we need a predictable, stable environment. The things that will help our businesses grow the most are investing in workforce.
So you'd keep them where they are.
I wouldn't make changes to the budget compromise that has recently been passed after a lot of hard work by a lot of people.
Okay, that was Colin Van Osten and Jack Heath on WGIR earlier this week. Obviously, Ali, you've spent a lot of time sussing out the business tax debate at the State House. You know, regardless of who gets in, I mean, I guess it would depend on the constitution of the legislature, but I'll put this to both you and Kevin. I mean, would you see really any appetite to ratchet back up business taxes? You
I
first.
Don't. No. I mean, I think we've seen revenues come in very high this year, especially from the business taxes. And while Republicans have sort of been claiming credit for that, for cutting the taxes, you know, that's really not I don't think that's a valid argument, just given that a lot of the changes haven't really taken full effect yet. And this really could just indicate that the economy is sort of rebounding now. So I think, you know, obviously the budget has in it sort of a lever that if the revenues don't come in as scheduled, then the taxes won't the tax cuts won't take effect. So I don't think that that there is really an appetite next session to change that, just given that there already is a safety valve in case that these cuts don't go as expected, and suddenly we have, you know, a big drop in business tax revenue.
So, Kevin, do you think, given, you know, this is a open, you know, open seat, open, you know, competitive primary, that in the sort of post-Bernie Sanders era, are you at all surprised that you don't have candidates running the Democratic primary, staking out a more full-throated, sort of, you know, fiscally liberal policy in terms of, like, touching revenues or not?
No, I'm really not. I think Democrats have won 9 of the past 10 elections for governor for a reason. That reason is they haven't touched the third rail. They've all said they would veto a sales or income tax. And even though certainly I suspect the electorate that will vote in this September primary on the Democratic side, if you strap them all up to a lie detector, a majority of them would say they support a change in the tax structure. But this is a case where the political leaders in their own party are behind the membership and believe in a general election. It's a suicidal step. And that's why you saw Steve Marchion, who's been the one who was most reticent to take the pledge, essentially just said, look, I see the appeal of an income tax. But he said, look at what's happened in Connecticut and New Jersey, the two states that imposed an income tax because they wanted to lower their property taxes. Connecticut and New Jersey now are two of the six highest property tax states in the country. And I fear that's what New Hampshire would become if we had an income tax.
He was certainly standing there when Mark Fernald ran on
the
tax in 2002.
He was
part of his campaign.
Yes. Yeah, and it's also the case that I think the Bernie Sanders phenomenon that we saw here in New Hampshire in the primary, it's a fairly new thing here. I think that the Democratic Party is in the process of transitioning a little bit. All three of the candidates, Van Ostern, Connolly, and Marchand, they've been around for a while, and I think there's a little bit of a hesitancy to kind of move too far away from the model that has worked for Democrats for so long. But there may be some, you know, sort of young person interested in public service who, you know, 4 years or 8 years from now, if the party keeps transitioning to the left, may be in a position to do that. But I do think that these three individuals are still kind of constrained by our political culture as it's evolved really since Gene Shaheen won in the 90s.
All right. So on to the Republicans. I mean, they're quickly before the break, as competitive as the Democratic primary, Kevin, you think?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, it started out, I thought Chris Sununu, I didn't think he'd win it easily, but I thought he was the front runner. And the family, you've elected a governor and a U.S. senator and a congressman. You're pretty good at this. He's laced a lot more blowback than I thought. Ted Gatzis, I think, is running a very good campaign, supported by some top-notch political operatives. Jeannie Forster's been a surprise, too. I think a stronger candidate than I thought she'd be. And Frank Edelblue is winning all these straw polls. He's got the Tea Partiers really excited by his candidacy.
All right, coming up, more top New Hampshire stories from our weekly news roundup on NHPR. Thanks. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477 or by email at exchange@nhpr.org or via Facebook or Twitter. So, okay, I want to move to a story you've been reporting on a little bit, Allie, the demise of Concord Steam. If all things go into a plan, the company, I believe it heats up to 180 buildings in Concord, including the State House in Concord High, could go offline in less than a year. What's that going to mean?
Yeah, so, you know, this has been kind of on the radar for a while. The state fire marshal has found some serious safety issues with the building. If you drive through Concord, you've probably noticed it. It's off Pleasant Street. There's a big stack next to a field. You've probably seen it. And so the issue now is that Concord Steam has announced that they hope to shut down in May of 2017 and then transition their customers to Liberty Utilities, move them onto natural gas. And for the state, this is a shock because Officials had been hoping to actually transition away from Concord Steam. They'd been planning to move away, but they had put out an RFP to get that process underway by 2019, which is obviously 2 years after the steam plant now plans to close. And they had hoped to pay for it with energy savings in this kind of unique model where they would contract with someone and the savings that they would generate from their energy bill would actually pay for the work being done. Now that's all unraveled given this new timeline, and state leaders are sort of scrambling to figure out how they're going to heat. There's roughly 25 state buildings on being heated by steam now, including the State House, the State Library, most of that complex, the Hugh Gallon complex off Pleasant Street as well. And what they've come up with is that it will be roughly $15 million to put boilers in all the buildings that would then be able to heat them. That's obviously a big expense, and they don't have the money in the budget right now to do that. The other option is that Liberty Utilities said in the agreement that the state could run Concord Steam for an additional 2 years while they transition their buildings to natural gas. The state actually owns the plant but has leased it to Concord Steam for a couple decades. I think the fear that state officials have about that is, you know, how much experience do we have running a steam plant, and could that be pretty costly just given some of the safety hazards at the building? So they're sort of in a pickle right now.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever been in the plant itself. I've gone on candidate tours there, and it's very 19th century down there. I mean, it's just like open, you know. I mean, you could, you know, shoot a movie in there or something. And, you know, you think of all the steam heat we've soaked up at the State House. You know, it's helped so many lawmakers and the occasional reporter drift off to sleep during a slow committee meeting in the afternoon.
Myself included.
Yes. I mean, is the PUC approval of this, first off, Allie, is that looking certain, the you know, Liberty's takeover?
You know, I don't have too much insight into the PUC commissioners, but I would assume that it is something that they would approve. My colleagues interviewed a staff member there who said this seems like a good deal going forward. You know, obviously any utility shutting down is going to cause problems, and no matter which way you slice it. So I think it does look likely that they could approve this. Again, that would happen in May of 2017. And so I think what the state is planning to do is that, you know, there's obviously a budget process that will resume in January. And part of that is the capital budget. So I think they're hoping to get some money approved that they could use to kind of figure out the situation. Obviously, the problem being most bills aren't signed until June. The plant is going to close in May. So this will sort of depend on lawmakers' ability to act quickly, which, you know, is always sort of up in the air.
Yeah, and it also speaks to, I mean, Allie's story also speaks to how generally big a pickle this is. I mean, when you have a utility, a public utility, Liberty Utilities, essentially say to the state of New Hampshire, hey, you guys can run the plant. You know, we'll provide the power, but you can run the plant. You don't have to be a public utility in order to operate that plant, which says, this is Liberty Utilities talking, with the current makeup of that plant, we're not interested in being the administrator, the operator of the plant. That scares the state even more. The state becomes the operator of a power plant. I mean, just the enormous liability issues that present themselves if there were to be a problem, they scare the heck out of the state.
Well, and I think part, just to add to that too, you know, in the state's long-term plan, they've always hoped to raise that plant and turn it into a parking lot. So I think the prospect of, you know, turning it into a money pit for 2 years and then just demolishing it and building a new parking lot is not exactly, you know, the fiscal responsibility that lawmakers in the state hope to, you know, impose.
I see that plant pretty much every day, and it's been very interesting to me to kind of learn about the history and some of the big issues. And, you know, Liberty Utilities, anybody who lives in either the south end or the west end of Concord, I mean, they're sort of rebuilding the infrastructure for natural gas and sort of a constant process of upgrading. And this really has increasingly felt anachronistic, and I think the writing has been on the wall for a while.
All right. Why don't we turn to a couple of First Amendment issues that were in the news this week. First was, you know, quashed gag order and the defamation lawsuit pending against Manchester businessman Michael Gill by three prominent businessmen, Gill of the colorful, we could call them, South Willow Street billboards. You know, the plaintiffs had sought, you know, a gag order against Gill during the pendency of this trial. The record would suggest Gill's quite a hard guy to quiet down, and, and certainly the ruling out of Rockingham County Superior Court says he can speak freely.
Yeah, it does. And Michael Gill, who runs Mortgage Specialists, which at one point was a huge provider of mortgages, still is to some degree. This has a long history of animosity. Gill and initially the banking department went after Gill's company. They essentially over not fraudulent loans, but inadequate public disclosure of the terms of loans that they were getting involved in. They essentially agreed to a settlement amount, but that set Gill off, and he's been on a crusade against the state government and the judicial branch ever since. I mean, look at this case. We've had two – the animosity has been so such that this is the third judge on this case, meaning the first two had to recuse themselves because Gill has had run-ins with both of them. Gill's had run-ins with the third, Will Delker, a former state prosecutor who's now a Superior Court judge. But Delker has said, I can be impartial, and I'm going to be impartial, and I'm not coming off this case, even though Gill tried to get him off it. But as we've seen, this was not a unique decision. In a lot of defamation cases, it's extremely rare to issue a blanket gag order against one of the parties while the case is being sorted out.
So another interesting First Amendment issue pending this week, Allie, involves a reporter at your paper and some reporting that the Monitor did on the state's desire to have Monitor reporter Nick Reed testify potentially against Carl Gibson, who was a Democratic campaign worker who, back during a special election for a House seat in 2015, emailed a fake concession statement purporting to be from the Republican. He was charged with tampering with an election, voter suppression. The state wants essentially the confession that was delivered in a quote in your paper, which was what Gibson said to reporter Nick Reed, quote, "I probably had a few too many beers when I sent that out, and it was a prank. I thought I'd play in the heat of the moment." Is this case been a discussion of the discussion that people have at the paper within the newsroom? Has this been something people have been talking about?
Yeah, I think any time that one of these issues comes up, it is something that reporters are watching just to see how the judicial system will respond. This actually took place a couple years ago in a primary. Nick interviewed someone who allegedly sent out an email saying that a candidate for state rep had dropped out of the race, even though that was not the case. She was still running, and she actually eventually ended up winning her term. So I think this is something that we are concerned about and watching and taking a stand on in the court to make sure that reporters' rights aren't discounted.
Yeah, and then what was interesting is that the judge had granted the motion saying he doesn't have to testify, and the state is actually seeking to go back, claiming that getting sort of the explicit in their minds confession on the record is important in this case. And Kevin, as you know, that there's been lots of scrutiny over the years of the aggressiveness or lack thereof of the Attorney General's office in prosecuting cases involving election fraud and election tampering. This was a fairly clear-cut, set of facts, but it'll be interesting to see where this goes and within the broader context of the history with the Attorney General's office with these issues.
Yeah, no, it will be interesting to see where it goes. I'm going to make clear I'm on the Monitor's side. I'm on Nick Reed's side, that's for sure. This isn't a murder here. I mean, we really want to violate a reporter's right to their sources over a voter suppression case which didn't succeed. I mean, where at the end of the day, there was no harm.
The victim won.
Exactly. The victim won. So we still want you to produce your goods. That's extremely troubling for me. Particularly, it's very troubling too, given, quite frankly, we live in a state in which there's a very weak right to know law in this state. There aren't sunshine laws in this state. We as reporters have to work much harder than reporters in other states to get information the public's entitled to.
All right. Let's turn to another matter of sort of criminal justice, and that is the ongoing scrutiny and investigation of sexual abuse at New Hampshire prep schools. St. Paul's sent out a letter to alums and, you know, have notified law enforcement of investigation of a long ago former faculty member, a chaplain who, you know, may have been involved in abuse. And interestingly, the statute of limitations may have been not have run due to the fact that he left the state. You know, Phillips Exeter, that continues to be in the news, developments there involving the state police. Dean, I know you've been following this stuff.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix of a look back at events from long ago in the 60s and 70s, combined with some fairly recent developments involving current cases. And so, you know, St. Paul's, for example, the victim's family in the Owen LaBrie assault case has now filed a civil lawsuit against St. Paul's, blaming them for the assault. And St. Paul's has denied culpability. But we're still, I think, seeing the ripple effects at that institution as a result of the whole LaBrie episode. And then, you know, you mentioned Exeter as well. And the county attorney in Rockingham, Patricia Conway, has requested that the New York State Police get involved in investigating a number of tips about different episodes. So it is a sort of interesting combination of, you know, delving back into the history of some of these institutions combined with, you know, still ongoing concerns. It was just that case about the student who had to bake bread as a penance for assault at Exeter. So, you know, it's interesting to watch these sort of, you know, venerated, very wealthy, established institutions struggle with both a long-term legacy and you know, real 21st century concerns about how they operate.
Well, in the civil suit against St. Paul's, it's interesting because obviously you know, a lot of boarding schools who've been under scrutiny are struggling to present a more sort of positive face in terms of the degree to which, you know, sexual, you know, predatory behavior and or sexual misconduct by students, a clear message that it's not tolerated. You know, but in the civil suit, St. Paul's bottom line, according to the court filings, was like only, you know, Owen LaBrie knew what happened. And, you know, that's kind of tough on a PR front.
Well, it's interesting. Well, you also see a number of alums kind of help circle the wagons for some of these institutions. You're also seeing a lot of alumni speak out and push back against their own institutions to try to reform the process. Yeah, Kevin.
You've had alumni certainly at Phillips Exeter Academy put a petition together, 800 of them, basically saying we're withholding public support for this for a venerated school unless they get their act together with regard to this. But Dean's right, and often these schools have pretty powerful figures in order to plead their case. I mean, we certainly with regard to this this Reverend Howard White doing that investigation, in-house investigation, St. Paul Schools. Scott Hochberger used to be former Attorney General of the state of Massachusetts, another powerful alumni for St. Paul Schools, certainly Archibald Cox, the Watergate prosecutors. But I'm with Josh in the intro to his question. I'm glad I wasn't the only one that was kind of startled with their statement. It's okay. We're blameless here. But I don't think you start out the statement with only J.D. and Owen LaBrie know what really happened, because I realize he was convicted of basically a computer crime, and that is on appeal. But certainly in the St. Paul community, I would submit a majority of folks in that St. Paul community think they have a pretty good idea of what happened, and they think it was a crime.
All right, so what are you all going to be doing next week? You know, it's been a busy – I mean, it's late summer. You know, there's lots of political activity, but what are you going to be keeping your eyes on next week?
Well, certainly the gubernatorial campaign is going to demand a lot of our attention. Soon we're going to get the first campaign finance report from the candidates for governor. I also want to look at some of these state senate primaries and on the Republican side. We've got some Tea Party candidates running against more established candidates. And this is a year that's so crazy. Some of these folks could win in September. We don't really know, and I'm going to poke around.
There are some crowded primaries. We had a story on this morning about District 24. Yeah. That's one where, you know, swing district, Nancy Stiles retired, and, you know, wide open, people with name recognition, people with money, and it'll be interesting to see where that one heads. Allie, what are you looking at next week?
Sure, yeah. Actually, the Monitor, we are working on a series about living as a transgender person in New Hampshire. And, you know, obviously North Carolina's bathroom bill and Governor Maggie Hassan just signed an executive order that would protect transgender people in state government. So we've been talking to some transgender people in the community about what's been changing for them, what are the biggest hurdles, and just going forward looking at rights for those people and what it means for them to be in the state.
Dean, keeping your eyes peeled.
Yep, absolutely. I'm also going to be filling in for Laura on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. A lot of politics. We're going to talk presidential politics. We're going to talk statewide races. We're going to talk about this issue of all the retirements in the state Senate. So if you're interested in presidential politics and New Hampshire politics, I'll be here talking about it most of the week.
All right. You heard it here first. Thanks so much. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Josh Rogers. Have a good weekend.